Good morning. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by Raj Bala. He's Associate Dean of International and Comparative Law at KU, and he's literally written the book on international trade law. It's called International Trade Law, an interdisciplinary non-Western textbook. It's in its fourth edition, and it is giant. Raj Bala, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
When did the first edition of this textbook come out?
1996. It came out the year after the World Trade Organization was born in 1995 and 2 years after NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, entered into force in 1994. And I happened to be sitting at some conferences that were organized for practitioners of law, and they were about NAFTA and the WTO, and I thought, how on earth are we going to update our curriculum in law schools and teach our law students about these revolutionary changes in the field? And so the textbook was born.
It might seem obvious, but explain just how those two things shifted the perspective of what it means to really comprehend law.
Yeah, well, before NAFTA and before the WTO, trade law was somewhat of an arcane specialty field. It focused a lot on tariffs, some non-tariff barriers like quotas. But with NAFTA and the WTO, the agenda, the topics, the table of contents really broadened and deepened. We now saw coverage of agriculture, of services, of intellectual property, of labor rights, of environmental rights, of antitrust policy. So it became a much more interdisciplinary and intradisciplinary field. And then at the time when NAFTA and the WTO came into the world scene, we saw a lot more activity from developing countries and least developed countries. And today now, about 80% of the WTO's membership, they're developing countries. And many of our partners in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the new TPP, which is highly controversial, some of them are developing countries like Vietnam. So everything changed. Those are real paradigm shifts.
But it's interesting to me that this isn't an exploration of the paradigm shift from the United States perspective. It's from other perspectives. Why do American law students need these other perspectives?
Because as the National Intelligence Council pointed out in 2014, the unipolar moment is over. Our law students who are going to be practicing across the next 50, 60 years or longer are not going to be living in a world that is dominated by one country. They are going to be living in a world that's increasingly non-Western, where there are different centers of powers and influence, and most importantly, where commercial transactions cross traditional lines. We now see a lot more trade between developing countries than we do between developed and developing countries. And all the statistics suggest that our law students are going to be working on deals that involve the likes of India and Korea and China, sub-Saharan Africa. So we need to prepare our students for the future with new teaching materials.
What kinds of things do you find in this textbook that you wouldn't find in other books on international law?
Well, I think one set of things you find is what you've hit on right away is the emphasis not on being Eurocentric, but rather on the pivot as the U.S. calls it towards Asia. There's a lot more emphasis on Asia and the Middle East and Africa. That's not to say that we don't talk about the important cases. We've had some great disputes with the European Union over bananas and foreign sales tax corporation, all sorts of interesting ones. But definitely trying to reorient and shift a little bit. That's one. A second, I think, is that there's a lot more emphasis on social justice and different social justice paradigms, including Catholic social justice theory, are discussed in the book because the students, while they, of course, don't want to be imposed on, they want to be proposed to. They want to know how to look at human trafficking in the context of a broader trade agreement like TPP, or how to look at green goods and services in the context of the WTO discussions.
Well, could we do that? Could we look at human trafficking in the context of the Trans-Pacific. I forgot the third word.
Partnership.
Partnership.
Yeah, partnership. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we have been doing that, and this was another area of controversy. What happened during the negotiations towards the end is that mass graves of trafficked people were found on the Thai-Malaysian border, and a number of non-governmental organizations and human rights groups said that on account of that finding, we ought to pause and consider whether or not Malaysia should be included in the TPP. Thereupon followed a big controversy about Malaysia's status in our annual human trafficking report, the official one that comes out of the State Department. In the end, Malaysia was included, but we don't yet have an actual legally authorized text that's been disclosed of TPP, so we don't know what it's going to say about human trafficking. And that's kind of another subplot is transparency. The only text that we have so far, which I have not seen, has been leaked to WikiLeaks. So this has not been the most transparent set of negotiations either.
What do we know about the TPP?
Well, we know that we know the members. We know it's got 12 countries. We know that it has 30 chapters. The U.S. Trade Representative has put out a summary, as have other countries' trade ministries, like New Zealand. It's got 30 chapters, and they cover the big range of topics that we talked about. We know that it will eliminate tariffs on about 18,000 goods. Across up to 30 years. That's a long phase out period of tariffs. It's not that all barriers to trade are going to fall to zero immediately. And I think that's a really important point for all of us to appreciate. It's not a free trade agreement. What we know is it's a managed trade agreement. To give you an example that's important to our region, the beef tariff in Japan, 38.5%. Well, that's going to come down to 9%, but only across about, say, 15 years. Likewise, the rice tariff in Japan, well, that's going to stay pretty high, like maybe 778%. There'll be an expanded tariff rate quota for rice from the United States, but they're still going to maintain their barriers, the Japanese will, on rice. And you can go on many sensitive products. In fact, they were even called sacred sectors in Japan, that they didn't want to raise. So to answer your question, it's not a pure free trade agreement. We know that.
Well, so this is interesting because it seems like you would have to understand not only law in these 12 different nations, but also culture, because when you're referring to certain areas as sacred.
Absolutely. And that goes that ties together a couple of your questions. What you see in the textbook is the importance of being sensitive to local cultures. Rice, beef, and wheat. These are beans, corn. These play special roles in certain cultures. And we can't just mercilessly plow down barriers. We have to respect that it may take some time for those trade barriers to come down on the sensitive products. And there's another piece of this. And Japan pointed this out in the TPP negotiations. Its farmers are aging. Japan, like China and Korea, are aging populations. If they are to eliminate their barriers overnight to rice exports, say from the United States or from Vietnam or Thailand, those elderly people will have nothing to fall back on. I mean, that is to say, they will be wiped out, their farms. So they gave a demographic-based argument that, look, we need to provide some adjustment over time for our older farmers to deal with the foreign competition. That's part of the kind of the culture and the demography that is part of the trade calculation.
Let's get into another specific. Talk to me about how U.S. cotton subsidies affect people in Africa.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. And this came out in the World Trade Organization negotiations, and it came out as early as the start of the Doha round in November 2001, but definitely by the 2003 Cancun ministerial, it was pretty clear. So here's the story. Econometric evidence indicates ballpark that U.S. cotton subsidies cause price depression in the world market price of cotton between 2% and 12%. Now, to be fair, it's not just U.S. cotton subsidies. China's actually the biggest subsidizer of cotton, and the Europeans do also.
So this caused internationally and other places the price of cotton to go down.
Right, because what it does is by subsidizing your production of cotton in the U.S., China, EU, the result is more output from those subsidized cotton farmers in those areas. They put it onto the world market, that output. And with a higher supply on the world market, prices fall. Well, the cotton four countries in sub-Saharan Africa are Benin, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Chad. Now, those four cotton producing countries, the cotton four, they have roughly 1 million, maybe 2 million cotton farmers. Roughly equal balance between Christian and Muslim population, and generally have not been susceptible to Islamist extremism. They've not been joining the likes of Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram. They have been producing their cotton, selling it onto the world market. But their profit margins are not 2 to 12%. So when world market prices of cotton fall, those cotton farmers are in peril. They are often they go bankrupt, driven off the land. Where do they go? They go to cities in West Africa. They clog the cities. They create more environmental problems. And then some of them try and get jobs. And this was all pointed out on the floor of the WTO. They try and get jobs. Some of them get jobs as lorry drivers, truck drivers. They take their trucks with their shipments up and down West Africa. Some of them might frequent prostitutes, and they spread HIV/AIDS. So from the U.S. perspective, it's not in the national security interest of the country to have a small number of cotton farmers benefit in this country, or for that matter in Europe or China, from large cotton subsidies, when the cost is not only the spread of dreaded diseases in West Africa, and we know diseases transmit easily across borders, but also impoverishes farmers that may then become susceptible to extremist ideologies and start joining the very organizations we certainly don't want them to.
Is it unconventional for someone in international trade law to think about cost in non-financial terms? Because that's what you just did.
It depends how far back you go in time. If you go back to the ancient trade debates about international trade between Plutarch and Horace, no. They talked about these sorts of logical chain connections. But if you focus just since Adam Smith and David Ricardo in 1776 and 1819, respectively.
Invisible hand of the free market, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Then the debate was narrowed to cost in financial terms. And going back to your earlier question, what do you see in these two volumes of the textbook? You see a lot broader, I hope, thinking to encourage the students and the readers to think broadly about all of the costs and benefits of trade, including the non-monetary ones.
What is it at the heart of international trade law that really interests you? Is that something you can pinpoint?
Yeah, and maybe it's confessedly a bit naive. I still believe in the idea of peace through trade. That is to say, and this was President Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of State's vision, Cordell Hull, that it is possible for nations to grow closer to one another through greater interdependence thanks to their commercial transactions. If you and I are trading with one another and we're benefiting from that trade, we're less likely to be at each other's throats. And that was the vision that Cordell Hull had in the depths of the Great Depression. Now, no one is saying that countries are all of a sudden going to stop warring.
Or stop competing in trade.
It's a healthy state when our competition is on trade. It's that we want to have disputes about sanitary and phytosanitary standards of poultry going into Russia. That's a good thing.
Why is that a good thing?
Because the alternative was debating over deployment of nuclear missiles in NATO against the Soviets. So in other words, if our debates are over peaceful matters of trade, that is a maturation of our relationship. We're seeing that a bit with India now. It's really interesting. The trade relations between the U.S. and India have gotten a bitter over issues of IP and solar panels and a number of other goods and services. But that is actually, if you look historically, a maturation of the Indo-U.S. relationship, because when I was a kid in the 70s, India was either part of the non-aligned movement or was outright aligned with the Soviets through a friendship treaty. So now to see us arguing about that, I think that's great. And those are much more solvable issues in a peaceful way.
What is your own background? I mean, where did you grow up and where do you think that your passions kind of stem from?
Oh, right. Well, I'm blessed in so many ways, you know, with my family. And my dad was from Punjab in India, and he was a child of the partition, the British partition. My mom was Scottish Canadian. My wife is Malaysian Chinese. We're blessed with a daughter, and we've taken her to 28 countries. And through seeing those countries through her eyes, as well as, you know, through all my other family members' eyes, I think that's really influenced me a lot.
Understanding that you're understanding many different systems in the world when you understand the codes of law in different parts of the world. Does that work make you think about the system you live in?
Yeah, it makes me think a lot about the idea of American exceptionalism and just how exceptional is our legal system. And I think I see a lot more comparisons and similarities than I do contrasts as I you know, get older and get to study more systems. I'm not saying that the U.S. system is not exceptional. It has its special features, but I think you do see more universal themes and trends. All right, law of precedent. Precedent. We learn in law school that the doctrine of stare decisis, a precedent, is a unique American, Anglo-American doctrine, and I suppose technically that's true, but in fact, in the actual practice of trade in other countries and at the WTO, you do indeed see non-Anglo-American trained lawyers looking to previous decisional law cases for, if not outright precedent, at least very strong guidance. And that, I think, that's an interesting trend to see over the last 20, 30 years.
You must watch the news so differently from a layperson.
Well, I you know, we're all inundated with news, and so I suppose my focus, I try to be more focused in what I watch. I try and focus on what's trade related, but of course that's a big area, as we've discussed, and what's also related to Islamic law, you know, the other field that I try and cover. So,
and you actually taught Islamic law to people in the U.S. Army.
Yeah, the U.S. Special Operations Forces are a truly amazing group of women and men, and it's very humbling and a great honor to work with them. And basically, each year we have a course at the Command and General Staff College, and we do a course in Islamic law for them.
That must be really fascinating. And actually, KCUR has reported on that. You're still doing it, though.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's all the time we have for this discussion with Raj Bala. Thank you so much for joining us from KU's Law School. We appreciate your time, and I hope to touch base with you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
To listen back to this morning's conversations or anything else you've heard on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. It is super easy, and you'll never have to miss an episode. You can also talk to us anytime on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, tune in for a food show. We'll have coffee and donuts, which sounds pretty good to me right about now. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Andrea Tudhope and to Michael Byers running the board for us today. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date. next.